from the campus of the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School.
This is Wharton Moneyball on Business Radio.
Welcome. Welcome to Wharton Moneyball. Welcome to 2 hours of sports analytics here on SiriusXM, coming to you via Zoom, as we have been for more than 2 years now. This is Cade Massey hosting with all my colleagues, longtime Wharton Moneyball collaborators. Audie Weiner sitting in his office in the new business school building on the University of Pennsylvania campus. Eric Bradlow at home. Shane Jensen at home. Not long. Audie and Shane about to slip out of here for the Phillies game tonight. Lucky guys. Gentlemen, Tuesday afternoon, good to see you. The show will go up tomorrow morning. We've got a full 2 hours to do. We're going to start as we usually start these days with a little COVID-19, and then we'll roll into the world of sports. What in the world of COVID-19 has caught your eye over the last week? Audie Weiner.
So the big news in my neck of the COVID woods is a new article that was published in Nature, which, if you don't know, is probably the premier science, one of two premier science journals in the world, certainly in the United States. And it's an article about cardiac events related to both the infection and from the vaccine. And the data comes from Israel, which is, as we've long talked about, has lots of very good data. And what they did was they looked at the time series of calls to emergency medicine that eventually are designated as cardiac related. And actually divided them into two types. I'm not going to get into the details, cardiac arrests and other non-arrest cardiac problems. And what they did is they tracked that simultaneously as with the rates of infection and the major periods where vaccination was being promoted and uptake by the population. And then they actually stretched back the data on the cardiac events way back before the pandemic, so they can sort of see how stable it was over time. And they noticed two very big changes. One was right around COVID, where various cardiac events increased, and you can really see that in the time series. And the second burst is, and a much larger burst, was during the first wave of vaccination, the two doses that you got. And in particular, they looked at the younger people, which actually is extremely important, because you are much more concerned about the side effect of vaccination with young people because the effect of the disease is much less virulent. And so you have to balance the cost-benefit analysis. And what seems to be from this data set, the ultimate result is a very large, obviously statistically significant, but also practically relevant increase in the rate of cardiac events, specifically and strongly related to the vaccine. And their major point was that and this is actually somewhat of a turnaround to what you're hearing up until this time, which is that the rates of myocarditis in particular, but other events as well, for young people, they define that as 16 to 39. They didn't look at even younger kids, but 16 to 39 was the age bucket, is much larger from the vaccine than it is from the infection itself. And of course, they've also recognized that infection isn't going to be prevented by the vaccine. And so they're making a much stronger case, particular with regard to boosting, that it's probably not necessary.
Okay, so hold on, a couple of clarifications. The most important clarification in my mind is that this is aggregate data only. They don't know they're not following individuals and seeing that once they've been boosted or vaxxed or whatever, they have an increase. You're saying at the aggregate, and are they doing it at the country level, or do they do something more geographically specific than that?
It's country level. I mean,
country level.
But what that is a good point, because one of the things is why it's very difficult to follow individuals, like in a clinical trial might do. And I've been talking about the lack of clinical trial data where you have placebo controlled and you track. The problem with that is these events are so rare in this age group to start with that you need tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people to get statistically valid results on essentially very.
Well, Adi, that's what I was going to ask you. Since the baseline is extraordinarily low to begin with, and if I look, I skimmed the article quickly. I thought they were saying there was potentially an effect size of about 25%. My question becomes, which one is a larger effect, meaning the increase in the myocarditis due to the potential, due to the a vaccine or the risk of COVID and possible complications from COVID. So which one has a larger effect size? It's clear. I'm sure it's clear to people. I hope it's clear to people that they can assess that the vaccine created an increase in myocarditis. But if you were going to look at death propensity, which one has the larger force?
So the complication, of course, is they didn't even look at deaths because that's even rarer in this age group. And most cardiac events do resolve. And the real question is, down the line, do they cause problems? It's surprising. And we in the sports community are well aware of athletes who just die out on the field. A lot of those events are thought to have been the result of earlier asymptomatic cases of myocarditis. So they actually discuss some of these things in the paper.
No, but I'm saying it's possible that, again, the vaccine increases the propensity from a very, very low rate, which you said, to 25% times 1.25 times a very low rate. But the probability of severe complications now from COVID on the myocarditis scale is worth 80%. And therefore, net net, it's better.
Well, actually, so you mentioned the 25%, and actually there's a little bit more complicated than that, because it looks like the rate goes up 25% and then an extra 25% with the vaccine. So the
With the boost?
With the vaccine. They don't have a specific broken down by boost. They have it really just with the two doses of the vaccine. So the boost is just a speculation.
I'm sorry, to make sure I understand. So it's 25% increase with COVID itself, with the infection itself.
And then an extra leap on top of the previous gain. And one of the things that they noticed was with the vaccine, the leap is highly coincidental, but I mean, they're happening at the same time. In other words, they build a regression model with a time series, actually use what's called a negative binomial regression. And they could see that as the vaccine periods were very precise, they get very strong increases in myocarditis and cardiac events timed with the vaccine uptake. They don't see that with the waves of the infection. And so one of the points that they were basically making is, and I haven't gone through the math, Eric, so all I can say is this is what they report, is that the incidence of heart complications are much larger from the vaccine than they are to the increase due to the infection.
So I think that's a really fascinating finding. But I would have to believe, by the way, and look, I would have to believe, though, exactly the type of calculation you're describing, if the CDC or someone isn't doing this type of calculation that we're just talking about now. I don't want to call it criminal, but it would almost be criminal. Like, what are you doing then if you're not doing a competing risks model, which is what right. This is? This is exactly, you know, you got two horses running towards a bad finish line, and which one of them's running at a faster rate? And this is the classic competing risk story. And the answer is, you might be right, Adi. They don't know enough yet because, A, the base rate is so small. The sample size, there's millions. Yeah, but millions times a tiny probability. And as you said,
one age group.
And it's one age group. And as you said, it's the long-term effect, not even the short-term effect. And the long-term's not here yet, maybe.
So hold on.
They actually had one other result, which I thought was really quite fascinating. Turns out all the talk about the myocarditis was with males.
Right.
And it turns out that, you know, one thing is really true is that heart problems manifest themselves very differently in women than in men, very differently. And this study actually seemed to see some of the biggest increases in women. Because remember, they're just talking about all cardiac events, not just myocarditis, which is a certain type of presentation. So they actually, one of the warning signs that they said was you got to look much more closely at what's happening with women, because we may be missing a lot of consequences that might show up later down. Now, again, none of these things, they're not talking about death rates here. They're not even talking about specific cases of serious illness, because they can't count those things yet. They're just looking at calls to emergency departments and showing up at hospitals with cardiac-oriented, rapid heart. So many people, if you look at the caveats and warnings, they'll say all kinds of things like, you know, this is stressful times, right? All kinds of things can explain changes in these really terrible, confined, stressful periods. So it's really hard to understand causality and what these things really mean. But it is a data point.
You know, what's one of the things that I've learned over this is that you would make a belief, and we don't know this. I've learned a lot about these kind of like what I call dose response relationships over the last 2.5 years, because what you're saying, Adi, is let's say the short-term effect is that the increase in myocarditis is, as you said, 25% plus possibly another 25%. The implication you would normally think would be, well, of course that means there's going to be a massive increase in long-term effects. But we actually don't know that. This is my mistake, not the field's mistake. If you had told me 3 years ago, I would have said, well, if you give somebody more dose and there's more of a short to medium term impact, of course that means it's going to impact somebody in the long run. But we actually don't know that. And so that's really interesting to me. But you're right. This is clearly an advance in our short to medium term knowledge about the impact of the vaccine on a given age group. No doubt about it.
Well, other than this is an observational study, not a controlled experiment, and it's not the actual like outcome. It's these like hospital call-in type things.
No, I said on this outcome, but Shane, this age group.
But I have to say, what's fascinating about it, it's very absolutely valid. But all the recommendations on the pro side are also backed up with the same observational studies with the same concerns. And this is, you know, I'm getting back to this issue.
Well, the vaccine's an actual clinical trial, though.
No, but none of the vaccine side effect issues were powered up to handle anything.
No. Shane's talking about the flip side, which is, you know, what's
by pro side, I interpreted it as to take the vaccine.
To prevent illness and serious infection, certainly at the population level. Absolutely.
We know that more precisely than this side effect stuff.
That's the thing we definitely know. Although that's very interesting because we certainly knew this about Alpha, whatever you want to call it, the original variant that it was tested on. It prevented infection, let alone serious. I mean, it was a slam dunk. It was out of the ballpark. The fact that it ended up preventing serious infection later on has really held up. But we're looking at, you know, obviously hundreds of millions of cases, and you can really tell the effect of the vaccine on illness and death. Although it's hard to disentangle some of the effects of natural infection. But when you look at the small, younger age groups, that's where things get really murky because you never had many observations there to start with. And we're looking at that's the group for which anybody has any issue. It's not the older people because at that age, the value of the vaccine and the boost is sort of unequivocally much larger than any of the consequences related to the vaccine itself. But yeah, we're not concerned about inflammations and, you know, also we have weaker immune systems, so they don't react so strongly as a young person's immune system might.
Well, we could have been clear about this from the beginning, that the main point of having this conversation is that it informs the vaccination, and especially the boosting conversation we've been having for a few months now, and increasingly energetically. I have a few questions, follow-up and clarifying questions. This age group is older and broader than we've talked about in the past, 16 to 39. Historically talked about this heart issue as like 16 to 25 kind of thing. Yeah. I assume this is just how they have the data, so that's what they're stuck with. But what's the commentary and discussion around that?
They didn't actually break it up. I mean, we can only refer to for things that were earlier talked about. I mean, there's the Paul Offit quote, he's at CHOP here. He basically said, "I'm not recommending a booster for my son who's in that age group." That's all that we really know. And that really, really seems to be the deciding. There are some numbers on the actual incidence of myocarditis in that age group, 16 to 24. It seems to be about somewhere between 1 in 3,000 and 1 in 6,000 per shot. That sounds pretty small, but that's the number. And remember, 95% of myocarditis cases resolve, but 1 in 20 is.
Tell us what myocarditis is.
That's basically an inflammation. It's a heart inflammation.
Isn't it the lining of the heart?
The lining of the heart. The muscles around the heart. Okay.
And the real question is what is it for the vast majority that resolve? The real question is what's the damage it would do down the line, particularly to elite athletes. That's the group who stress their hearts.
Well, now we're really not. It's not relevant to the debate if we're going to limit it to elite athletes. But this long term thing was my
elite athletes not taking the vaccine is a big part of the debate in society. Sure. I have to say
that's their case. By the way, they always claim that you don't study things on me, and therefore, what do I?
That's interesting. Okay, well, the long term effects is one of my questions here because we're pitting essentially in this debate long term effects of heart conditions of younger men against, let's say, long COVID, because this is another one of the things that people do a lot of talking about and still kind of poorly understood. It strikes me that you're waving your hands a little bit at the potential long-term effects of these heart events in a way that you might not accept when people wave their hands at long COVID. Is that fair?
Only in the sense that, but I'm not sure it is fair. It is fair because you still get infected with even though you've been vaccinated and boosted. And the real question is the vaccinated and boosted less likely to have long COVID? And I think that's true, but we're still waiting on some of that data. And I mean, if you think about it, I mean, I had a conversation with someone at Penn about our students, and we have 1,000 varsity athletes. And the word that I had was, he basically said all of them have had COVID many twice. And of course, all of them were vaccinated, all of them were boosted. And his response was none of them, at least he didn't do a serology study. He can't recall someone who's suffering from long COVID. So a young person doesn't seem to get these. And if they do, and there are people, of course, have them, they're certainly not more frequent than the baseline rate of these long events that always seem to happen. And there are lots of people with fatigues and kind of all kinds of problems, and particularly young people. And so that background is very hard to tease out. These are in some ways intractable statistical problems, but pretending that there isn't risks is not a good solution.
Okay, fair, all good. One last question, this one methodological. I'm curious for the whole group. How do you feel about the correlational nature of this and the single geography? And in particular, I'm curious, there must be other countries that have fine enough data and large enough distribution of population to run these same correlations, but with this additional covariate of geography. Because wouldn't that be nice here to see that not only as the country goes up in vaccinations does the cardio events go up, but you see it differently in different geographies. Am I right to think about it that way? Because in some, even though you usually like homogeneity in your study populations, because it's correlational, I have the intuition that I'd rather have one more like treatment variable.
Yeah, I mean, homogeneity is nice as far as the precision at which you can estimate something about that population. But of course, it really affects the generalizability of it. And Israel is a very different kind of demographic situation compared to most other places in the world, including America. So, yeah, I mean, I assume, again, it's because most of the kind of more diverse sort of nations do not have the kind of comprehensive sort of collected healthcare data situation that Israel has. That's really why we keep, I mean, Israel is not an ideal kind of study group, certainly not a representative study group for the world.
No,
you know, in terms of demographics or anything, it just is one of our study groups because they have, you know, again, the most sort of comprehensive sort of like, I guess scientific kind of basis for doing studies, which is
a much
more closely monitored population.
There's a national health service that you have to be in. Yeah, there's a couple of choices, but you have to be in one of them. And everything is connected. Even when you do a rapid test, that's recorded. Imagine that. We don't have anything remotely like that. The second thing is they made this deal with Pfizer in order to get rapid access to the vaccine to collect a lot of data. And that was their deal. They have to collect everything and do a good job of making it available. Mm-hmm. So that was that makes it the reason why they have all this. On the other hand, there are got to be other countries. And the only one that comes to mind is England. Right. They seem to be putting out a lot. They'll probably have something of this nature eventually too.
Okay. Speaking of other countries, South Africa apparently is seeing an uptick in two subvariants of the Omicron. And people are all of a sudden on watch. I mean, this is like notable uptick there. And in fact, it's been observed in the US, and just the question is whether it's going to take off. Have you guys paid much attention to this? Are you worried? Do you think what is the chance, fellas? What's the chance that we do see enough of an uptick of some variant or some subvariant in the next few months that would change, you know, our daily lives or the public policies that we're living under?
So I was waiting for the last part of your sentence to see what the implication is. I think the likelihood of there being another surge of cases due to another variant is quite high. I would put that as more likely than not. How about that? And matter of fact, as you said, Cade, we're seeing that now. But the likelihood of it changing our daily lives, I'm going to guess that through the vaccine programs that, you know, are still effective even against the variant, maybe not as effective. They're working on this, you know, universal vaccine right now that they claim will be ready by the fall, which will be even more effective. And
what is the meaning? What is the meaning of the term universal vaccine?
I think they mean a much broad. That's the term they're using, but nothing's universal. It'll be able to defend against a much broader spectrum within the COVID class, if you'd like. Certainly, all of the variants we've seen so far, and they believe other variants as well. And also, I think
hold on. That's interesting. Are they saying that we're going to predict some additional possible variants and we're going to get ahead of them?
Yes, because I think the way that that vaccine will work is multifaceted. It won't just affect where the virus attaches on. It's actually got in some sense, a multiple type of defense. And so that's why it's kind of more universally protective, because it's not specific to a given variant.
I don't really understand the science of it all, but you know, the way I kind of think about it is like, you know, back when they were developing the first COVID vaccine, all they had was the mean that they could essentially target because there was only alpha. Now we've got data on kind of the mean and also a little bit about how the variants vary. Right. And so I think that's probably part of what kind of can scientifically inform a more multifaceted approach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The other thing I was going to say was, you know, again, Adi's been talking about this drug for a while, but, you know, I think Paxlovid is considered to be fairly effective. And I think if, you know, maybe as a matter of fact, I've seen some data suggest the best masks when properly used, Paxlovid, and of course the vaccine are all in the 90%+ effective range. Now, of course, Paxlovid you have to use at the appropriate time because it's not effective if you use it too late. It's not a preventative. That's what vaccines are for. But my guess is that there will be, you know, they're working on oral, they're working on pills, they're working on things that don't require. I think there's a hesitancy because of people going in and getting shots. I think there's going to be, you know, you're symptomatic, you take a dose of pills, and I think that's likely to be more effective. So that's why I was waiting for the last half of your sentence, Kate, which is that's going to affect our daily lives. Yes, I think there's going to be a surge. Yes, I think there will be for the unvaccinated and the people that aren't using masks, I think there will be an increase in deaths, but I don't think it'll have the same societal impact.
Yeah, so I do want to emphasize the societal impact of it. By our daily lives, I mean the kinds of shutdowns and policy changes that have economic consequences. I'm sorry, Adi's trying to jump in here.
I don't think it's going to do a thing, only in the sense that cases will go up. Just to point out, South Africa does not have a strong vaccination base. They have a very strong natural immunity base, but they don't have vaccination. If anything, we suspect the vaccination provides much better protection against the future variants than the natural infection.
Exactly.
So natural infection is extremely good at the infection you got, the version you got, but less good than the vaccination at preventing future. So I think we'll see whatever they're actually start seeing an uptick. I don't think we'll see it here like they're seeing it. And secondly, I think we have much more access to all these medications that Eric talks about. Well, we're just going to just slough it off.
Let's hear just a bit more on that. On Paxlovid, for example, what is the window for efficacious treatment, and what's the eligibility? My sense is that you're supposed to be older than 60 or something in order to have access for that.
Well, you're getting your primary care physician to prescribe it and get access to is hard if you're under 65 and if you don't have a serious comorbidity. So if you're just like, you know, us and you get COVID, you're never going to get Paxlovid right now. We're just talking about making it much more widely available.
I have a scorecard here right from Yale that talks about it. First, it's 89% effective. Okay. Second,
mean keeping you out of the hospital?
Yes. 89% effective. Yes. And they're, by the way, they're doing phase 2 and phase 3 trials now on younger people. I'm just reading this now. So yes, you have to take it within the first 5 days. You take 3 pills twice daily for 5 days. So it's 30 pills that you're taking. And again, right now, the FDA authorized Paxlovid for people 12 and older who weigh at least 88 pounds. So it's authorized. It's authorized for people right now.
But is it availability then?
Well, that's a different thing. The answer is yes, it is available. But again, you have to get it. You have to get it prescribed.
So I have a friend who got it after getting COVID and had a low blood oxygen level from a home test, went to the ER, and immediately was given Paxlovid. And that
under
was
six, under 65.
Barely, but yes, under 65. Okay. So that's just one data point. No obvious pre-existing conditions, just was seeming to have a hard time with the infection.
Right.
The rates, by the way, is the Paxlovid data. It is about something like, remember that serious illness was very rare in the control group, but it was even rarer in the treatment group by a factor of 10. So the uncertainty bounds are a little high, but the p-value was essentially zero.
Okay. So what the generalization of this idea that we're going to take pills, that pills are going to be available, what's the sense of when those things, because we're talking about the vaccination, the more universal vaccination, maybe another round in fall. What about these pills that are going to make it all so much better?
The numbers I've heard are in the, I wish I could tell you the answer would be, there's going to be hundreds of millions of them ready in like a month, but that's not the numbers I've heard. I've heard the numbers like they'll be able to produce a couple million a month. And so, you know, by the end of the year, they might be able to produce 20, 30 million pills, that's which is like a million doses.
Yeah.
Okay. So again, it's going to be a question of eligibility and availability and network relationships and all those kinds of things. Shane.
So, yeah, I mean, I guess the thing I'm curious about kind of, I kind of agree with everything that's been said before, but I don't think there's going to be a situation where we change public policy dramatically again in the future. Assuming, you know, it stays endemic, is it, I guess it's too early to kind of predict what kind of baseline death rate we'd be dealing with COVID. Like, you know, we know flu's been around forever, and it's like, you know, between 10,000 and 80,000 deaths per year, kind of that range. Obviously, with COVID, you know, if we called it endemic and just we're higher than that now, right? We're still several hundred per day. So what do you guys think will be kind of the baseline sort of like yearly COVID death rate?
Geez, that's a good question. And I don't have a basis for it.
I mean, we can probably lower bound it at flu, maybe. Yeah,
which is between 25 to 50.
You know,
annually.
And we can hopefully upper bound it on whatever we're currently at per, you know, multiply up our rate right now by 365.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, if we did that, that would be about 100,000. Then,
yeah,
that would be 100,000.
So already, that's kind of, you know, that's a relatively tight range.
Yeah, I would say, good question. I would say I would be surprised. Well, I think if the death rate extrapolated out, which as we all know is not really exact, I wouldn't do it that way. But let's say you did. I think if it gets above 100,000, like in other words, if we go back to a time where there's 1,000 deaths a day, and so you multiplied it out and conceptually it would be 365,000 deaths, they're going to take public action at that level. At 300 a day, I don't see it. But if you're telling me 300,000 to 400,000 people are dying each year from COVID-related illnesses, I don't see how they can do nothing from that. I just don't. That's a big number. That's 10 times the flu. That's a big number.
No, but it also has to be, it would have to be much higher than that. Because remember, it ebbs and flows. So if it's 1,000 a day, just you wouldn't see that. It has to go, it can't be 1,000 a day. It either has to be a low amount, like 100 to 300, or a much higher amount. It's not going to stasis at 1,000. It has to be a lot higher or a lot lower. That's all.
All right, guys. That has been a COVID-19 discussion for this week. Some big developments, and there still seem to be big developments coming down the pipe every now and then. We will continue to keep our eye on it. Meantime, we have 3/4 of non-COVID-19, much more sports-related content ahead of us, beginning with Q2 after the break. Come back and join us after the break.
You're listening to Wharton Moneyball
on Business Radio.
Welcome back. Moneyball. Welcome back to 2 hours of sports analytics here on SiriusXM. We have the whole crew in here, Eric Bradlow, Audie Weiner, Shane Jensen. This is Cade Massey. You guys can jump into the conversation, and we wish that you would. You can reach us on Twitter, at WMoneyball is our handle up there, at WMoneyball. We follow all of our guests. We tweet about the world of sports and sports analytics periodically, every now and then COVID-19. And we hear from listeners. Send us your questions, your ideas, your critiques. We get mocked on occasion. That's okay. We're up for it, whatever. You can also send us email. We have a mailbag via email. The address is moneyball@wharton.upenn.edu. moneyball@wharton.upenn.edu. We read everything you send in, and we're glad to hear from you. We get a lot of suggestions. We get some questions, and we get as much of that as we can on the air. Please reach out when you feel the need to. All right, guys, we have a couple of interviews in the second half of the show, most of Q3 and all of Q4. And so this is kind of our open topics opportunity here in Q2. I want to hear something from everybody. What's caught your eye in the world of sports? Eric Bradlow.
Well, I'm going to steal Shane Jensen's sport, Mr. Hockey. But let me say something nice. Let me say something that caught my eye. So the Colorado Avalanche, right?
Yeah.
They had a great season this year. Great season. The Panthers
incredible.
And Colorado had both had incredible seasons. But when I looked at the betting line tonight, they're -330 against the Predators, who, by the way, had 100 points this season. So this is not a bad team by any stretch of the imagination. I was just surprised, given the randomness in any given hockey game, that any team – it's not a 120-point team playing a 60-point team. This is a 120-point team playing a 100-point team. It surprised me that the betting odds were -330. The Panthers are playing the Capitals tonight, and that betting odds -260. That just seemed like a very steep odds for two quality playoff teams. So that's the thing that caught my eye. Like, just given the randomness in hockey, you know, the implied odds of that Colorado one's like an 80% chance of winning the game. Maybe Shane could tell me differently. I don't think Colorado has an 80% chance.
No. I mean, I agree with you. And I mean, that's kind of part of what caught my eye as I was kind of getting excited about the playoff brackets for the NHL playoffs that are starting or that have started. We've got kind of, just to kind of give a little extra context to what Eric's talking about, the Florida Panthers and the Colorado Avalanche, one on each sort of side of the brackets, have had like a top 10 and are in the top 10 of wins. So these are historically good teams. But as you sort of said, I mean, we had, you know, one of the top one of tied for the top team a couple of years ago, Tampa Bay, in terms of wins, flame out in the first round. And I mean, I agree with you. The NHL playoffs are very famously not chalk, or don't go chalk very often. And so, you know, I'm not sure, you know, I would bet very highly on either of those two teams necessarily, you know, certainly not at 80% probability winning any game or even the series.
Yeah, what I was thinking was I didn't have enough time this afternoon to look at the data, but like even Colorado and the Panthers, who must have won, I don't know, 80% of their games this season or 70% of their games at least, which would give you 114. Let's say they won 70% of their games. That's a mixture distribution between games against bad teams and games against playoff teams. I guarantee you neither of these teams is winning 80% of their games against playoff teams. Right. So even just using that base rate, odds, so Kate asked what caught my eye in sports. I was looking at hockey. I was looking at the matchups and the fact that, not surprisingly, in the first four games that were played yesterday, home team was 2-2. I understand small sample, but it's the same old thing in hockey. And you know what? If we look after today, 2-2, it's going to be 2-2 again. It'll be my prediction.
Okay. Let me give you one other observation off of hockey and in the four games that started yesterday. When y'all think about a typical hockey score, just give me a typical hockey score from your
4-2.
That's higher than I would have thought.
I would have said 3-1.
Yeah. Well, 4-2, yeah, you're really blowing it for me, Eric. There was an average of 5.5 goals scored per game last night. It just seems high. The Leafs won 5-0. The Canes won 5-1. Blues won 4-0. And the Kings and Oilers put up 7 goals together. It's just scoring is up. And there have been some discussions lately about why scoring is up. There's a long article on ESPN this week about scoring being open, all the possible reasons for it. But as a casual fan, I'm supportive. I like these games. There's more excitement when the score is up there. And it's at least yesterday in a small sample, I would say it was significantly up. Okay. Adi, what caught your eye in the world of sports over the past week?
Oh, come on. This is such an easy and obvious one.
And I love the Yankees.
The Yanks haven't lost since our last show. That's it. The Yanks have not lost since before our last show.
Ten in a row now.
How often
since
do
our last
teams?
Show? I think they've increased their lead over the Red Sox by about 8 games or so.
Yeah. So they're right now in a series in Toronto against Toronto's number 2. They played a terrific close game last night that was ended by a old fashioned small ball stolen base in the ninth inning.
Oh my!
And a single, right? You know exactly the things you don't expect to see.
That was great to watch.
It was great, but basically it's a 10-game winning streak. The meat of the Yankees, the heart of the Yankees lineup basically came alive with Rizzo, Stanton, Judge turning it on. And it looks like the Yankees are moving away from the albatross, Joey Gallo, who's good on sabermetric paper, but in the actual field, he doesn't seem to be turning out much value.
The Yankees are also pitching well. I mean, if you look at the scores of their games, I don't remember. I'll look in a second. I don't remember the last time, like you say, oh, well, it's a 10-game streak, but they won 14-20. No, I don't remember the last time the Yankees gave up more than 5 runs in a game. When?
They did. They won one about 12-8 a couple days ago.
Maybe one of those 10 games.
Yeah. Do you guys see something in the Yankees this year? Because they had some streaks last. They were a very streaky team last year as well. And in fact, I feel like there was at least one interval during the season where they were winning. It seemed like they would never lose again. But, you know, do you kind of see any reason for greater consistency this year?
Yeah, there's 3 areas. Their starting pitching is just much deeper, without a question. Last year it was Cole and nobody else. This year it's Cole Severino, and then you got this Cortez character who's been a journeyman, but looks like he's got some.
So you're sort of saying that's kind of, I mean, you know.
Well, right now, Shane, if you just look at runs,
you just brought up two pitchers that I think are probably high on the uncertainty going forward meter, right? Severino, he's consistent. Yeah, right.
But just to be clear, if you look at runs against, the only team better in the major leagues right now is equivalent number of games is the Dodgers. The Yankees are better pitching team right now than the Mets, than the Twins, than lots of other of these, you know, Cardinals, great pitching. The only team that's better right now, the Yankees are better than the Giants.
So it's starting pitching. Their relief has always been terrific, and they look just as good as ever. And the other thing is, I mean, the uncertainty, of course, is the bottom half of their lineup. And if they're all below the Mendoza line, the Yankees are going to be in for a lot of trouble. If their stars at the top go a little bit, you know, cold simultaneously. And so, yeah, I don't think it's as strong as a team as it should be. I mean, you can't have a starting nine where the bottom third really don't produce. And for that. But it looks like the Kiner Falefa seems to be doing better. He's up near 300 in his average producing. Where else Donaldson seems to not be doing well. But anyway, that's where it stands with the Yankees.
How rare is a 10-game streak?
It's pretty rare. I mean, there's probably like 3 or 4 per season, I would guess, at most.
I mean, for a 50-50 team, you'd see 1 in 1,000, roughly.
So that's 1 every 7 years?
Yeah, for a single team, but you got 30 teams. So, you know.
That's for 50-50. Where these guys are, the best teams are what, 70%?
70%?
That's a lot. 65%, two-thirds. Yeah. Let's say two-thirds.
Okay. So I would say there's got to be 5 or 6 a year, maybe.
Just by the way, I quickly scanned, Adi. In all the Yankees games this year, only twice have they given up more than 5 runs in the entire season so far.
Yeah. All right. I'm going to say a couple of things. There was an article, again, ESPN recently grading the first month of the season for each of the teams. One that stood out to me was the Los Angeles Angels. They received a good grade because they're off to a good start. And ESPN reported that FanGraphs have them at 71% chance to make the playoffs. Why am I excited about that, fellas? We often bemoan on this show that we don't get to see Ohtani and Trout because the Angels are always underperforming, especially Trout, who's been there a lot longer. So is that going to last? Are you excited about that possibility?
I mean, I'm excited about it. And I mean, like, I'm cheering hard for the Angels to make the playoffs because I would love to see those guys in the postseason. I think, you know, again, I'm cynical because they do seem to always kind of underperform. I think it's also like, it's not even like as much underperformance. It's just they're in like that division with this juggernaut, the Astros, that have made it to the ALCS, like what, the last 5 years or something like that in a row. I mean, we're kind of counting on, you know, I mean, you have to count on not just the Angels continuing to perform well, but also somehow the Astros continuing to slip. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's wild card positions and stuff like that. There's other ways of doing it. Just obviously, I think, you know, the last few years, they've been really kind of cut out of that division because Houston's been so strong.
So my take is that I would actually, if you're going to offer me 71%, I'm betting against. I think that's an overvalue.
Me too.
The Angels, they haven't made moves that justify revaluation. So I would essentially say, you know, they're what's called the stars and scrubs model. So they have a couple superstars, and there's nobody better than Trout. And he's like doing it again, right? There he is once again, leading all the leagues and everything. But the rest of the team is not only scrubby, but the bottom of scrubby. I mean, really, really mediocre. and I just don't see they're going to – you got the Astros, you got the Mariners. It's not going to happen for them.
Okay. All right. Interesting. All right. Shane, what's caught your eye in the past week?
Well, I mean, Eric kind of stole a little bit of my thunder by discussing hockey already. I'll just kind of put one more plug in for hockey. Other than something to watch in these first rounds is, of course, again, I think the Florida Panthers and Colorado Avalanche, do they make it through to the second round? Do they kind of live up essentially to their billing as historically good teams? I also, of course, out of my own historical heart, want to put in the possibility. Let's all cheer for the fact that Calgary and Edmonton could end up meeting in the second round here. Right, there could be a battle of Alberta, which it's been a long time since that was a thing, but it's very exciting that is even a potential option for the playoffs because it's been a long time since it was. So let's all kind of pull hard for that.
We should probably just be cheering that they're both in the playoffs, right?
I mean, that's why it's such an unusual kind of possible outcome is it's rare for those two teams to both simultaneously make the playoffs. But
right,
thankfully they're 1-2. If their part of the bracket goes chalk, they will meet up in the second round.
Okay.
Maybe what caught Cade's eye is that James Harden has scored for 11 straight playoff games under 25 points, which is actually a remarkable streak for someone that scores at 25 plus a game.
If they limited faculty seminars to one question per faculty, Eric would say, you know, I think what Audie wants to ask here.
I mean, this is unbelievable, this James Harden. I mean, it's got to have caught all of our eyes. This guy is so done. But okay, Cade, let me ask you, what caught your eye? Since you don't have to ask it yourself.
I've got one, but I want to hear more about Harden.
Yeah, my question, Eric, is that how much of it, I mean, I guess it's been for a while now, but how much of it is they're able to kind of focus on him now that Embiid's out, right? That's a big part of the problem.
Well, but he's only been out the last game.
Yeah, just one last game. I don't know. I don't know. There's probably some focus on Michael Jordan in his heyday. Maybe some focus on Kobe Bryant. I don't know.
I mean, if that was the standard you were holding.
Well, I think I'm just saying Harden's not an all-time great, nor is he near an all-time great. That's been my point. He's not a bad NBA player. Let's not put him in the elite NBA players. He's never been
an all-famer.
He performs markedly worse, though. Markedly worse in the playoffs. That's always been my point.
Eric is kind of dismissive of that outer ring in the Hall of Fame. He really holds out for the inner ring.
He's an average player. Well, also, of course. I mean,
maybe let me twist around my question a different way. Like, he is a very historically unusual player, right? He's got this kind of play, like, you know, kind of weird way of playing the game that maybe he's able to kind of accumulate more gaudy statistics against bad teams, but he can kind of be more easily kind of strategized against in the playoffs. Is that
well
something?
Said?
Is there something
well
there?
Said, Professor Jensen. I agree.
Yeah. Okay.
I completely agree.
I mean, on the NBA, did y'all catch any of that I mean, it's fun to watch the Grizzlies and the Warriors play, right? Because you get
and all those Warriors. It was so heartbreaking at the end of that game.
Who are you pulling for?
I'm always pulling for the underdog. I wanted to see the Grizzlies win, and they turned it over twice, and Morant missed a layup in the last minute of the game. I'm not saying they had that game. It was anybody's game. But they did not play well in the last 90 seconds to 2 minutes of that game.
This isn't caught my eye, but what caught my eye in that game is Jordan Poole. I mean, he just continues to get better. And it wasn't even just his scoring. It was the passes. He was as impressive pass in his assist as he was in his shooting.
So now you not only have to deal with Curry, Thompson, and Green. And imagine next year when Weissman comes back and, of course, Andrew Wiggins. I mean, it's almost unfair. You're right. Poole may end up being that for the next couple of years. Poole and Wiggins may be the top two players on that team as Curry and Thompson age, but I mean, they're still really damn good.
If that franchise manages to pull it off, it'll be super impressive. They have the next generation ready to go before the last generation is out the door. Okay, my eye is unsurprisingly on the college football front. Y'all probably don't know this, but May 1st, i.e., whatever that was, Saturday or Sunday, was the deadline for entering the portal. So if a college football player wanted to leave his school, he had to declare that by May 1st. He didn't have to know where he was going. In fact, there's the only deadline on the other side is that whatever school's registration date is, but he had to declare that he was leaving.
Can you go in the portal and then, of course, decide not to go anywhere?
That's right. It happens all the time. In fact, the majority of kids who announce don't have a destination in mind. They're just hoping that they can shop or get picked up by somebody. But there's lots of discussion about, obviously, this is a new world, and this plus NIL, the ability to profit off of your name, image, likeness, is just really changing. It's really kind of a free agent market. And now there's all this discussion about tampering. There's this sense that schools are contacting other schools' players and encouraging them into the portal. So, for example, one of the best wide receivers in the country at the University of Pittsburgh entered the portal over the weekend, and it was big news just because he was such a good player, and it became it's seemingly clear that he has some kind of deal with USC, and that was likely a deal that had been discussed before he put his name in there. And this is the kind of new world that we're in. And people are kind of supportive of NIL. People are supportive of transfer portals, but together there are some unintended consequences. And it is, the cliche is it's the Wild West out there.
So the NIL, the name and likeness, the money for that, where does that come from? It comes from the team? No,
it can't come from the school directly. It could come from anybody, but except for the school. And so
we could do it, buddy. Wharton Moneyball could sponsor an athlete if we wanted.
Right, but when you say it comes from, there isn't discussions. What are the discussions about?
Well, schools can't do this. They can't direct people to sources of money technically, but of course they must be doing it. You're not supposed to use it to recruit. This is the remarkable thing. The NCAA is supposedly saying, it's just unbelievable. So like the example of being within the guidelines is there are places that are just paying all current players a certain amount or all players at a certain position, a certain amount. And that's clearly not, that may be an inducement to come there, but it's not directly aimed at the player saying, if you come here, you can sign this deal. But of course, this is just a technicality that people are either working around or ignoring altogether. So for example, some of the biggest deals are happening. Adi, this won't surprise you as a business school professor, but the things that evolve in with all this money moving around and with players this valuable moving around, the institutions that evolve to facilitate it are infinitely creative. So what happens immediately is these collectives have evolved where they buy the rights to market a kid's NIL. They basically acquire the rights from the kid in exchange for some money. It's all speculative. It's like, I'm going to pay this kid $1 million over 4 years so that I can use his NIL, and I'll figure out later how I'm going to use it. I'll find ways to, I'll sell it to entities that want to use it. But they're basically intermediaries, and they're collectives because they're often groups of people who pool resources in order to do this. And right now, everyone's just speculating on what the market value is. And the numbers are, it's literally hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, depending on the kid, depending on the institution, hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, 4-year deals. And no one knows if they're actually going to be worth this. And then there are other, there are still things that are happening that are more what you might have expected. Really rich boosters just cutting checks. So apparently University of Miami has a billionaire booster down there, and he's been cutting checks and come endorsed, you know, this business I have or that business I have. And they've done a great job of acquiring talent as a result. But it's, you know, it's not new to say, you know, gosh, this is a lot of players moving. No one is really seems to be in charge. No one knows what the rules are. It's all uncertain. It's just kind of at its peak right now, because in the middle of NIL for the first time, we've just hit the deadline. A couple other anecdotes to give you stories of what are happening. Over the weekend, I think, again, University of Miami, back to this booster, they're one of the best players in the ACC, threatened to leave Miami if he didn't get a better NIL deal. So it's not only negotiating with schools you buy transfer to or sign with coming out of high school, it's also negotiating. Supposedly, there's some player at the University of Texas who's like threatening to leave if he doesn't get a better NIL deal. It's a whole new complicated world, and it's going to be a little bit shaking up.
I think that's when you create a system that encourages entrepreneurial thinking. I have no problem with that. If you don't want it to happen, change the policy and put a restriction on it. But mm-hmm. Yeah, of course, schools are going to pay for players. Of course, players are going to shop around. Players are going to try to upgrade. Boosters are going to get involved. Yeah, sure, of course. That makes sense given the system.
We had a conversation, Eric, a couple weeks ago. Was it with Bill Connolly when we were talking with him last week or the week before? We were talking about the expected impact of NIL.
Right.
And you suggested that, well, here's, you know, another dimension a player might care about that didn't exist before. Isn't that likely to flatten the competitive landscape at least a little bit, not make it flat, but make it flatter than it has been? And I 100% agree. And we're seeing examples of that, of schools that haven't really been able to compete at the very top of the market.
Exactly.
Are stealing some players and competing. And that's, you know, if you thought it was becoming a little too concentrated, you probably like the fact that this is going to flatten things out a little bit.
Yeah. And why shouldn't the players get the value? That's fantastic.
Well, the question's whether it's swung too far the other direction and whether it's okay for a guy to be able to just leave any time of the year to leave the school. I mean, they did make him a 4-year scholarship offer. Well, I should say that these things are not technically all 4 years. Has it swung too far? And we don't have the answer, but it's possible that it swung too far. And even if you support NIL, and I do support NIL, and most people do, that players, there's so much money in the system that the players ought to be participating. Is this the right governance structure? It's just a complete unregulated free market. And there's going to be some swing back. I don't know how quickly it's going to happen. Over the next year or two, things are going to swing back and the balance is going
to
be.
But the idea is that a business, I mean, you could sell your name and likeness in order to make money like an advertising.
Yeah, exactly. So we're going to see all kind of creative ways it's used, but it kind of doesn't matter. I mean, the guys who are providing this money aren't doing it for economic return. They're doing it to get players on the field. All right, guys, that has been two quarters of Wharton Moneyball. We still have two quarters to go. Come back and join us after the break.
You're listening to Wharton Moneyball
on Business Radio.
Welcome back. Moneyball, 2 hours of sports analytics here on SiriusXM. This rolling into the second hour, Q3, mostly this quarter, we're going to talk to Benjamin Robinson about the NFL draft. Just a couple minutes to catch up with my colleague, Eric Bradlow, before we do that. Eric, did you take in the draft? I mean, you take in a lot of sports. How much of the draft do you manage to watch?
Well, I watched almost all of it because either on my phone or actually watching it. I think the two things that surprised me, there were a huge number of trades, which I think they even said it was the largest number of trades in the first round in like 10 years or something mm-hmm. like that, mm-hmm. which I thought was interesting. The second part was, and it was merely my son, Zach, who was tweeting at me and others and to Eric Eager and others, have teams forgotten about positional value? Like there was one guy in a draft to like sick that was like a center. And my son's like, a center? I don't care if he's Jason Kelsey. You're not drafted. Why are you why are you drafting a running back here? You know, his comment was, it seemed like teams had forgotten about positional value and what drives winning. And so that's the two things that caught my eye. Lots of trades and teams drafting excellent players, but out of positional value.
Well, it's an interesting question, positional value. And it seems, if you look at the first round anyway, the first round was pretty dominated by just a couple of positions.
Wide receivers drafting out of positional value, according to many.
Well, that's true. And one question we'll pursue with Benjamin is whether the wide receiver valuation has changed or whether the NFL is getting it wrong by kind of copying a few other teams. The thing that most caught my eye, I think, is that the Ravens used all six of their fourth round picks. I mean, going into the beginning of Saturday, I was like, this is absurd how many picks they have because of a variety of moves they've made. I thought they might do something with them. But, you know, they'll get one or two at least good players out of that. And here's the thing. They don't know which one or two it's going to be.
You've taught me that over the years. They got more coin flips now, and exactly, they don't know which one or two, but it will be one or two of them.
Well, let's take this up in a little more detail with Benjamin Robinson of Grind of the Mocks, who pays even more attention than we do to the NFL draft. Always happy to talk to Benjamin, especially after the draft. We always talk to Benjamin before the draft, but now we're going to do a little debrief with him and find out what he made of it. The NFL draft, of course, is what we're talking about. Last Thursday through Saturday, they picked a record number of players, something like 262 or so. Benjamin Robinson is the creator of Grinding the Mocks. Mock drafts have become not just popular, but a useful tool in recent years. And Benjamin runs probably the best known at his site, Grinding the Mocks. You can follow Benjamin @Benj_Robinson. And we're glad to see you again. Thanks for joining us, Benjamin.
Good to be back. And it was a marathon draft weekend. And by the end of it, I just wanted to go to bed, which I did.
Well, it's Tuesday afternoon now, so you've had a few days to recover. I'm curious, as you've sat with it in those 2 days, now with a little bit of distance, what did you think was most notable about this year's NFL draft?
A couple things. So number one is coming into this draft process, you know, everyone was kind of flailing their arms, you know, the sky is falling, this draft is going to be so unpredictable, it's going to be, you know, we have no clue what's going to happen. And then lo and behold, out of the top 32 players drafted, 30 of them were in my top 32 players. It's the most predictable draft, at least in the first round, that it's been in the entire, you know, 3 or 4 years that I've been doing Grinding the Mocks. So that's number one. Way more chalk than it was thought to be. In fact, when I was making my mock draft, I ended up going with 26 of my players instead of 30. If I had picked 30, I'd have had a much better mock draft.
Right. Well, what's your attribution there? Of course, performance is going to bounce around. Even if you're running the same model, some years are going to do better than others. Or is it that your technology has gotten better in some way? Or is it because there are so many mocks to pull into your overall system that the information is better? What's your attribution?
I'd like to think my system's gotten better and is good at learning. I think there's something true in all those things. I wouldn't necessarily know which one is more important than the others, which one we should attribute the increase in performance. You know, I think it's possible that because people thought the draft would be so unpredictable, they did a little bit more unpredictable things. And so the end result ends up being a little bit less on with what it would have been in the past. So I don't know. That's my like galaxy brain idea. But my idea, basically, for the most part, is that this might just be an anomaly sort of year.
Well, hold on. I think you're saying something terrifically interesting, and that sounds like a pretty parsimonious explanation. You're saying because there was more uncertainty, the mocks were less correlated than they have been in the past. And that's an empirical question, but that's one possibility. They're more independent than they have been in the past. And if that's true, then your aggregation of them is basically to have more signal in it than it has in the past. And that might be one way that the improvement is coming from. Okay.
I think it also has something to do with the quarterbacks. I mean, so that's the second thing I wanted to talk about was the quarterbacks, is that, you know, normally like you look at a draft like the 2021 draft where there were four quarterbacks drafted in the first round, but there was all this uncertainty at pick three. And if you ended up being wrong on pick three, then there was that correlated error that you're talking about. There wasn't that kind of like marquee player like that in this class. But it turned out that the league, you know, valued quarterbacks way differently than the mock drafts did. The mock drafts, so Grinding the Mocks top 32 had two quarterbacks. Kenny Pickett from my alma mater, the University of Pittsburgh, was drafted by the Pittsburgh Steelers, a very exciting story for Pittsburgh sports fans. And then Malik Willis, who was our number one quarterback, who ended up being the third quarterback taken, but he got taken in the third round. So I was glad that we only had you know, two quarterbacks in the first round versus three or more, because, you know, if you got that wrong, you were, everyone was kind of punished depending on how many quarterbacks. The best mock drafts had one or two quarterbacks in the first round.
Benjamin and guys, I'm curious what we make of the slide in the quarterbacks. I think the story, and we've said it here on the show multiple times, the story of the NFL and quarterbacks over the last 5, 6, 7 years has been an increasing appreciation for them. And we just see guys fly up the first round reliably from like January to April. They just fly up the first round. And this is an arrest of that pattern. All of a sudden, not only did that not happen, but they went not just positions later, rounds later than was expected. So what do we make of that?
You know, for me, one of the things that some smart people do, like the folks at PFF, is you would regress the mock draft expectation to the talent expectation, looking at what are known as big boards, the kind of ranking of player talent, even though the mock drafts and the big boards are fairly correlated most of the time. But even the consensus boards were really off on the quarterbacks. You know, even like, you know, Kenny Pickett and Malik Willis were usually ranked pretty closely together, but they went way, way far apart in terms of draft position. So it seems to me that everybody was just a little bit too high or way too high on the quarterbacks than the league was, and or the leagues didn't feel a need to push for quarterback at this point in time. In fact, they pushed really hard on wide receiver, which is the other piece of the draft that's really interesting.
Let's hear some thoughts from the other guys on quarterbacks for a second, because it, I mean, we're seeing the league is not known for agility and consensus beliefs, and we see a big shift here. So we really got the league wrong, and they really shifted this year in the way they're thinking about QBs. And I'm just surprised by that. I'm trying to understand it better. Eric.
So I want to ask the following question.
Hold on. Do y'all not have a position on the QBs? I'm curious. I thought you were showing.
No, I'm talking about the QBs.
Okay.
I'm saying, isn't there a potential massive advantage for this? I don't want to call it collusion, but them all sliding, because now, given the pay scale, if these quarterbacks make the team, and if they are the starting quarterbacks in the team, you're now getting them at third round pay as opposed to first round pay. I guess a disadvantage might be the number of years, you know, player option, fourth year, fifth year kind of thing. But isn't this like, if all the teams, I'm not saying they did, but if all teams could collude and get quarterbacks where they belong based on their grade, wouldn't this be advantageous for the teams?
Zero chance that four of them could collude, much less fucking 32.
I'm not saying they are. I'm just saying, let's imagine Malik Willis turns out to be a great quarterback, and now all of a sudden you got him at third round pay.
Good for whoever got him that number. It was not via collusion. That's for dang sure.
Yeah, and I think one of the dynamics, I mean, I think it's probably just idiosyncratic to this year, because there just happened to be this kind of dearth of kind of predictably good quarterbacks in this particular crop. But one thing is that, you know, I think we're sort of seeing one trend that we're seeing along with quarterbacks being increasingly valued, though, is that teams are kind of not necessarily, I mean, I think we've kind of dispelled this mantra that the only way to get a good quarterback is via the draft. Right. I mean, you know, there is more kind of free agent or trade acquisition. More teams are using those picks, trading those picks for good quarterbacks, as opposed to actually using those picks on quarterbacks, you know, increasingly. And so perhaps that's part of the, at least the dynamic that's happening this year. I mean, I think it's also notable. I mean, you know, once we're done with talking about quarterbacks, I think it's also kind of notable that the, I think this is the first time ever that there was no tight ends or running backs taken in the first round.
In 7 years, no running backs in the first time in 7 years. Yeah, I don't know if I buy your argument necessarily, Shane. I understand it. You know, we have this recency bias with this Matt Stafford deal, even though he was, you know, one drive away from not winning the Super Bowl, and the narrative looks a lot different. I say this as a Bengals fan.
Good point.
But still, like, there's no better cheat code in the NFL like a rookie contract, really. I mean, when we look at the Super Bowls of the last 10 years, it's either Tom Brady or somebody on a rookie deal, pretty much.
Well, Benjamin, let me ask
you.
I'm
not saying it's necessarily optimal moves. It's not just so much that teams are actually, like, you know, kind of – the Matt Stafford's obviously the great success story. But, I mean, you know, you think about teams in need of quarterbacks – have, you know, Washington, Indianapolis, all these teams, instead of deciding to take a quarterback via the draft, they just use that same pick to get a quarterback that's already out there.
Why not the development play? So they must say, well, these guys can't step in. I can believe that they can't step in because, you know, they're just not quite that player. But developmentally, as Eric was saying, they cost nothing, essentially, nothing at the most valuable position in sports. Isn't it surprising that someone didn't take a flyer until the third round on a couple of these guys? Just developmentally option? Yeah. Not now, but like even do the old Patriots thing of develop a guy and then trade him away.
It's not like they're free. That the cost is that you could take somebody else to improve your team especially in the first round. I mean, you are missing out on some other fundamental piece of your team. That's the cost.
This is quarterback, right? If I've learned anything about football, I've learned that quarterback is monumentally important, and therefore the upside potentially is justified. My statistical question is, though, centered on quarterback, is more specific. So this year you're arguing that the top two or three are a lot lower than they've been, at least in the last few years in my recollection. As a statistician, I wonder how likely that is. And it obviously has some probability. And I kind of wonder what that is. And potentially ask the follow-up question is, if that really is small, are we potentially mis-evaluating these quarterbacks? And that they may actually be gems?
I think so. I think it's worth the squeeze for sure. I find it hard to believe that the top quarterback in this class, or the second quarterback in this class, Desmond Ridder from Cincinnati, is not as good of a prospect as Davis Mills from Stanford or Kyle Trask from Florida. Like, I don't see that. So to me, I think that Adi's right. Like, there's more uncertainty probably here than we want to believe. And so for me, I definitely thought that not just because of my data that these players were worth a squeeze, but yeah, like the teams that ended up with these players, I think got really great value, and they were all teams that could use quarterback. One could argue that they could have gotten them earlier, but they got them later. So I guess who cares now at this point? But at the time, I thought that if I was a team, I would have gotten one of those guys in the second round. But then it turned out that everyone kind of valued them the same. Yeah.
Right. Somebody passed them over them, and they probably made a mistake.
Multiple times.
Well, we'll see. I mean, we don't want to wait to judge the decision, but right, the decision up front by 64 teams, 64 decisions to pass is interesting at this position. Eric.
Ben, just a quick question. Let's imagine that one of these quarterbacks does get to start. I'm going to play a statistical argument here. That's evidence that they must be really good, because first round quarterbacks get the, you know, what do they call it? The gift of the first round. But now if a third rounder makes it to the starting position, yeah, they get the halo effect. In some sense, if one of these guys makes it to the starting position, would you agree with the following? Maybe there's a greater chance they're going to be successful than someone that was a first rounder.
Oh yeah, I think so. I mean, draft capital plays a huge role. I mean, you kind of heard that when you guys were talking with Eric Eager last week. You know, he looks at contracts and he looks at player age and he looks at draft position. It's really important. But yeah, I think you're right that in this case, if, for example, you know, Desmond Ridder or Malik Willis really do make the starting lineup, then one could argue that, yeah, like they really did earn it. Whereas Kenny Pickett is kind of in a position where, for the most part, the team feels like maybe they have to start him because they were a first round pick. So one could argue the stakes are a little bit lower, but you know, every single team that drafted a quarterback in this class in the first few rounds, you know, that's Pittsburgh, Atlanta, Tennessee and Carolina, like there's a lot of uncertainty with all those teams. So it could happen. You know, it could happen. These guys could play even if they are bad because of injury.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I guess I just want to point out that, you know, we keep talking about how, like, oh, how could all 32 teams pass on these guys? I mean, there's really only six or so teams maybe that actually are looking for a quarterback, right?
No, not just, I'm talking, but there's a developmental option here as well. So will they be looking for a quarterback in the next 3 or 4 years? How many teams are set for the next 3 or 4 years?
The Bills.
Well, okay, but if you're not going to play him enough to realize, I think the kind of Aaron Rodgers sitting on the bench for 3 years is kind of the exception, right? I mean, if you just draft him now and then you say, oh, well, we're set a quarterback
Shane,
for the next
okay, that's,
3 years.
That's fair.
And you don't play him. I don't know how you observe his value and develop him anyway.
Shane, fair. I overstated 2 or 3 years. There's a window there. And again, there's market value for these guys as well. And I mean, why not grow them and sell them? We saw the Pats do it for multiple backup quarterbacks in a row. All right, we've beat that one a little bit longer. Let's do one more and then let Benjamin go. Wide receivers. This was going to be your third point. Everybody's talking about the run on wide receivers. Even the trades were for wide receivers. Is this rational? Is it reasonable? Is it hurting? Is it the change in the game? Was this truly an unusual crop of wide receivers, or is it just a different valuation?
So it was a mix, I think, of market forces, because it's the not only the wide receivers in the draft that, you know, I thought they were going to be spread out pretty evenly among the first round. There were going to be some guys who were taken kind of in the earlier part, starting in the top 10, late top 10, going all the way to maybe the end of the first round with the Chiefs. But they all, for the most part, the five wide receivers that I expected to go in the first round, pretty much all went by pick 16. And then there were also the trades from with the Titans making kind of a funky trade with the Philadelphia Eagles to get AJ Brown, and the Arizona Cardinals trading with the Baltimore Ravens in exchange for Marquise Brown.
Man, if you call the AJ Brown trade funky, what do you call the Marquise Brown trade?
It's the we went to college and we have chemistry. And I mean, there's that you've talked about this before, that maybe there's this unknown kind of effect there of people who have familiarity with each other coming back together. I don't think it's worth it necessarily for players we know that about, but maybe the, you know, Joe Burrow, Ja'Marr Chase connection is spreading. But the wide receiver contracts that came on the books this offseason, especially for kind of what I would call like middle tier wide receivers, were really, really high. And so I think these were all in reaction to, we have to pay this guy, but we don't necessarily have the resources that we would like to be able to pay them given the salary cap constraints. And they decided to go for the newer, younger model, even if the player was already established. AJ Brown, the Titans drafted this guy, Treylon Burks from Arkansas, who, when people were comparing him to previous players, compared him to AJ Brown.
So I heard some speculation that the Titans might've arranged that deal and then waited to execute it on the availability of Burks because they wanted to do that. And at that point, you're just
makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, you tip the hat to the GM because, look, the guy, he just got supposedly, not the same guy. Of course, there's uncertainty about that, but at a very different price. And Brown wasn't happy. My question, though, is how much of this is the evolution of the league and therefore player positional value? And how much of it is, wow, the Bengals sure did do well with a rookie wide receiver, and maybe we could just get some of that. Like the typical copycat thing.
I mean, I'd look at this offseason. I mean, the biggest trades have been for established wide receivers. Davante Adams, Tyreek Hill. Those were the big deals this year. And, you know, Maddie brings up a good point that, like, yeah, the Titans, you know, have Ryan Tannehill on this deal. They have Derrick Henry, who they signed to a deal. They have Bud Dupree, Harold Landry. They had Julio Jones last year that didn't work out. And so they must have felt that in order to kind of have flexibility in the future at quarterback, that they needed to have basically AJ Brown clone, but cheaper. And so I do tip my cap to them for making the tough decision that's maybe plus expected value, but it takes a hit in the short term. They were the number one seed last year. One could argue it a poor number one seed, but they were still the number one seed last year. And to kind of see that turnaround, it's pretty stark.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, listen, we're going to let you go, but before you go, being analysts, we're always interested in what analysts are working on. As you wrap up 22 draft and look to the 23 draft, what do you want to, how do you want to improve your model? What are you going to be working on? What frontier are you pushing to improve grinding the mocks?
You know, it's tough. I haven't had a chance to do a whole lot of soul searching. You know, I think for next year, the goal is to kind of incorporate into some of my private work, the idea of the kind of looking more at the dependence between these players, because we know that the probabilities of certain players being drafted at certain spots are dependent on what happens in the draft. Yeah. And so I haven't been able to incorporate that as well into what my probabilistic model does that I work, that kind of is part of my private consulting work for NFL teams. To kind of provide more power there to kind of look at, hey, if this happens in the draft, how do the probabilities change?
Okay, this reminds me of like simulating electoral outcomes when everyone's running these dumb simulations where Florida is independent of Pennsylvania. And then we realize, oh, hold on. If Florida goes that way, Pennsylvania is probably more likely to go that way too.
Yeah. Yeah. People have, I've often compared what I do to kind of 538, but what I do is a little harder because there's way more candidates at each spot.
Interesting.
And we're never going to predict that Cole Strange is going to get picked by the Patriots. So,
that's right. Yeah. That's right. Well, listen, Benjamin, always a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for being with us again. Wish you the best with your recovery from the draft last weekend and with the work going into next year. I know it's a full year's gig.
Thanks, gentlemen.
All right. Benjamin Robinson, Grinding the Mocks. You can follow him on Twitter at @Benj_Robinson. That has been three quarters here on Wharton Moneyball. We still have a fourth quarter, an interview segment with Jeff Cedar, our go-to horse racing guy, this week being Kentucky Derby week. Come back and join us after the break.
You're listening to Wharton Moneyball
on Business Radio.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Wharton Moneyball. Welcome back to the fourth quarter. Fourth quarter has become our interview segment in the time of pandemic. We are delighted in this fourth quarter to welcome back to the show Jeff Cedar. Jeff is an annual guest, at least, of our show, one of our favorite guests every year. It's Kentucky Derby week, and so it is Jeff Cedar week around Wharton Moneyball. Jeff, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Jeff is the founder, owner, and president of EQB Inc. He has been in the world of horses for 40 years, 40 plus years. He's a leading talent scout for young, unraced thoroughbred racehorses. He's also overeducated for the business. He's got all kinds of interesting background, lawyer, graduate degrees, fancy schools, and an unusual approach to identifying young, good racehorses. Jeff, tell us big picture first. I feel like this is about as quiet a Derby week as I can remember for a while. And I wonder, I can't help but wonder if it's not related to all the trouble the industry has had recently. And Baffert is a longtime multi-winner legend. Bob Baffert is suspended by Churchill Downs. He's not going to be involved. His horses won't be involved. What's your read on just the state of the industry and the race? Does it feel lower key to you this week, or have I just been distracted?
Well, the auctions that we attend, all the major auctions the last month or so, have been gangbusters, wild prices, runaway bull market. Who knows why? Seems to be new money, a lot of it from financial people. What a shock. And, it's muted because the last Kentucky Derby winner was disqualified. And now Baffert's been banned from the grounds of the racetrack. They won't even let him on the grounds of Churchill Downs for 2 years. And it's ugly stuff. And the federal government is taking over the enforcement of all the rules and the drugs, all that stuff, as of July 1st.
Is that
and they
right?
Just published the set of proposed regulations, and they are based on, according to the horsemen, draconian. You can't even put cleats, little studs in the bottom of the horseshoes. You can't use any medication anytime, and they're going to be testing out of all over the place, not just during races or after or before. And the permitted amounts are a nano thing, pico, whatever they are.
What's your sense of that? We talked last year, and we were all just kind of reeling from what had happened and how ubiquitous cheating seemed to be. I kind of remember your being with us on that. So given that, how do you feel about the Fed stepping in? They must not trust the industry regulators. How do you feel about having pretty draconian requirements?
Well, I think the PICO, whatever, is the billionth of a thing. I talked to the head guy who's the veterinarian who's going to be head of the drug enforcement kind of stuff. And now is deeply involved in it. And he said, well, we did a lot of research, millions of dollars worth. And we found out that when we found these teeny weeny weeny amounts, it didn't mean there was nothing there and it hadn't affected the horse. That was what you find when they had a dose that did affect the horse after all, when you go looking for it. And he believed it. So maybe he's right, but it sure is hard to believe. And one of the new regulations is that environmental contamination, like they said that there was whatever the hop was, one of the horses was found with, it can be found in gypsum weed that gets in the hay in California. And Baffert got off like 20 times because of environmental contamination. One of them was had a lidocaine patch on his back, and the lidocaine shows up with a picogram or whatever. you know, and they're not, that's not going to be an excuse anymore. And I, you know, it's going to be wild, and it's all strict liability. So somebody could frame you easily, you know, walk past the stall, and it's just going to be, and they want to hold the owners liable to them. I mean, that's going to scare a lot of people out of the industry if that one gets any traction. So it's very, I was looking forward to it, but it looks like the pendulum may be swinging wild to the other side.
Yeah, right, right. Eric.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, Jeff, if, you know, let's even imagine that these environmental concerns even were low probability, but weren't like, oh my God, he's guilty. Did they ever ask a statistician what the odds are that you'd have 20 such of these events? And, you know, the fact is that, you know,
of course not. That's a good one. Yeah. You have okay. So you have 20. I don't know what the odds are. And I'm reasonably sure they never asked, but that makes too much sense. I think it was Bette Midler said, if you're looking for intelligent life, you're on the wrong planet. The racetrack is Damon Runyon-esque. It's kind of the whole thing is like a hospital where all the doctors got their MD in a 2-week correspondence course. It's something else.
Well, Jeff, tell us about the importance of the trainer in outcome. So Baffert's out.
It's huge. It's huge. It's a game of one by inches and by, you know, a foot here or there. It's extremely complex. Small things make a huge difference to a horse. They're very, very sensitive animals. And some trainers are literally just much better. I know people who, you know, most trainers can't see minor lamenesses, and that's critical to a horse trying hard and getting and doing all kinds of things. There are all kinds of subtle erudite things, and some people can do that, and most of them can't. It's like any other profession. There's real top people who are much better, and those guys, you send your horse to them and they win, and you send it to somebody else and it loses, and it's not drugs, it's minor lameness and so forth. In my experience.
And then it becomes self-fulfilling, because once those guys get a reputation, they start having access to better horses. Their pipeline is better.
Yeah, well, you know, so some of the guys are just genuinely what the horse whispers. They're just genuinely much, much better horsemen. And there aren't a lot of great people in any profession. Mm-hmm. But there's also cheating, trying to keep up with them, you know, because everybody else has got these lamenesses they don't even recognize, or they can't do anything about it. They don't know what to do, or they won't wait. So they cheat.
Mm-hmm. Given Baffert not being there, given the increased attention to cheating, do you think the uncertainty goes up in this year's race? Is it
absolutely? Absolutely. And I do. I think it's, yeah, I think more people have a shot. Mm-hmm. Fear of God is coming into everybody.
Well, the market reflects
flowing
that,
down, right? Some of these people. And some of the drugs were exotic. I mean, one of them was some kind of, they call it frog juice. It comes off the back of some frog from South America, and it's hallucinogenic. Wild.
Well, you know, when there's strong incentives. Adi.
So two questions. The first question is, you talk about minor lameness as being a major problem. So first, maybe you could define it. And the second thing I'd like to know is, are there maybe modern computerized tools of some kind to help trainers detect it by looking at videos or some sort of comparison about a normal?
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of stuff coming online with accelerometers and transducers and stuff you can put in the saddle or put on their leg or something. And they claim that they can pick up abnormalities or stuff when it gets 2 or 3 standard deviations away from the mean of what the movement of the horse was before. But I don't think you have to do that. Years ago, we had a barn with my partner, Patty Miller, and we ran at Delaware Park, and we were just starting out. Nobody would give us anything but awful horses that were lame or slow. And she became, with a small band of those, a leading trainer that summer at Delaware Park. And we had the major tool we had was a heart rate monitor that we invented ourselves that was accurate on horses. And it was about the size of a pack of cigarettes. And when the horses went out to train, if they have a diagonal, a quadruped locomotion, the four-legged animals, there's a pattern to the legs. It's transverse gallop kind of thing. But anyway, they call it right diagonal and left diagonal, or the right-handed and left-handed. And they switch back and forth as they trot and as they gallop. And if they were 20 beats apart, on the one lead versus the other, we would not work them hard. And we would go look, we would pull out all the different diagnostic tools from X-ray to scintigraphy to try and figure out what was bothering the horse. So we just rested. And
Jeff, real quickly, just
make turned sure a lot of horses around that way. And that was just data, heart rate data.
Just make sure we understand those data real quickly. I think you said 20 beats per minute, heartbeats per minute difference, depending on whether the horse was leading with the left leg or right leg. Is that
that's right. Yeah.
Okay.
It's that sensitive. Okay. And it meant something. And you couldn't often see it. You had to go looking for it other ways. You had to block legs where you inject something that blocks the nerve until the horse goes sound and stops happening. And then you know that's where it is. Mm-hmm. A lot of these things. Or, I go to all the major auctions and I use high definition, slow motion photography, 500 pictures a second. And I look at them all running and I immediately, I went and saw 1200 horses. I immediately eliminated 80% up for all kinds of awful things that go on that are going to cause injuries and inefficiencies.
Well, give us
some
an example.
Those horses went for over $1 million, but you couldn't give them to me because they're going to tell people, oh, it had a bad step, but they're not going to make it.
Jeff, give us an example of something your high frequent motion camera is going to catch that leads you to eliminate them as a horse to buy.
Okay. Well, what they're going very, very fast, faster than they'll ever go in a race. One of the things they do is they go back at the knee so badly that it looks like a banana, the leg, when all the weight is on the foreleg and they're running like that. If you stop it with regular video, everything's fuzzy and you can't see it. But if you go enough frames, you can stop it and see it clearly. And the leg looks like a banana the wrong way. It's so far back at the knee. And there's several bones in the knees of those horses, and they bang into each other and they chip and it hurts.
And what do you mean by they go faster in a race? How is that? What are you talking about?
I'm talking about every stride in the race when they come down on the lead leg. Yeah. Their leg bends the wrong way so badly that it isn't straight. It looks like a banana.
Adi was curious why they're running them faster at these shows, at the auctions, than in a race.
Because they get more money for them that way. It's gotten to be ridiculous. There were the 1,200 horses this last auction down in Florida. Over 300 of them went faster than 10 1/5 seconds for an eighth of a mile. That is very much faster than they will ever go in any race the rest of their lives. And in fact, a lot of them did it by becoming sewing machines like quarter horses, bang, 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 bang. That's how they got the force for that acceleration, for that velocity. But that's terrible. You can't win a race that way. You can win the first half of the race. You get tired, you'll get hurt. So, they're buying these horses based on that. I've done statistical studies on it. The faster they go, the more money they bring. And there were, so they've perfected that. They've put in a new synthetic track and they perfected what the hell they do. I don't know how they do it. So they've now got almost a quarter to a third of the horses going these ridiculous speeds. So then the agent tells the guy, look at what 10 1, it's incredible. Cause it used to be incredible, 10 1 for an eighth of a mile. But now there were 300 out of 1200 doing that or faster.
So Jeff, tell us, in contrast to just looking at the time, since the time seemed to be evolving with technology and method in a way that's not diagnostic of their performance, just as a way of giving us insight into what you're doing. So you go down there with buyers and you unleash your analysis and your cameras and your technology, and then you tell the buyers, these are the horses that you should
make. And we look at how they go fast, not how fast they go. We bought the sprint champion, the world sprint champion from a sale, one of these sales that's coming up in about 2 weeks. And it had one of the slowest workouts in the thing. Went 11 1, which for that was very slow, but it was effortless and clean and smooth. So we look at are there flaws like the banana leg? So they're going to get hurt. And how hard was it? How one of the number one users of energy is the number of strides per second, the stride frequency. People think of it as stride length. It's extremely sensitive to velocity. So you have to know within a foot or two per second what the velocity was. And you have to see if the jockey's messing and they're pulling their head or they're doing this, they're doing that. Are they accelerating or braking? But when you get them, so they're none of those things, you want to know what was the average stride length. And then compare it only to other good horses. And we have thousands and thousands of 10, 20 years. Compare it to those to see where it is. Is this a long stride for that venue at that velocity? And I can tell my buyers it is or it isn't. So somebody says, oh, it had a 26-foot stride, or it had a 22-foot stride, or anything. But it's meaningless unless you know all the rest of that stuff.
So Jeff, tell us about knowing all the rest of it. So we're seeing what I think fairly can be called a biomechanical revolution in sports.
Absolutely.
And especially in baseball, increasingly in football and basketball. It feels like biomechanics have been your calling card in horse racing for some time now. Is that a fair
40 years? Okay. I mean, we've had the first Triple Crown winner in 37 years. We've had more grade one races are like the Kentucky Derby. There's only 100 of them in the whole world. And we've won, you know, again and again and again. We bought those horses for as little as $20,000. You know, if you go to our website, it's all documented. You can check it all against easy websites that to verify it all. You know, the statistics are there. In fact, I published a lot of the stuff, the data on one of the typical study would have like 10,000 or 12,000 horses over 10 years, a major racetrack, maybe blah, blah, blah.
Well, so and, Jeff, let me ask you.
They still, these guys are still using, they still, pedigree is more important to them, which is a predictor, but it's very weak. And the data is terrible because the market's so full of, it's a terrible, terrible database.
Let me ask you a question. Is there, one of the things you taught us over the years is that every horse slows down. The question is, which horse slows down less over the course of a race?
Yeah, in American dirt racing, yes, that's typically the pattern.
In the
turf races, especially in Europe, sometimes they lope along and at the end everybody rushes. But that's not what goes on in Holmes Bowl and major American races.
So I was going to ask you, is there any known empirical relationship between, let's say this, as you call it, fake top end speed that they're able to do for short distances and the decay rate in which a horse slows down? Like if a horse can run really fast.
Yes, it's inverse.
It's inverse.
Yes. Yeah, when they start pounding with more strides, a higher stride frequency uses more energy and they get tired faster. So they cannot carry that speed.
But are there horses that are just good at both?
No.
Okay.
There aren't. No, I mean, you may be fooled because the guy got the horse to run in 9 and 3, some ridiculously fast for 1/8 of a mile of furlong. And maybe when it slows down, it'll still look good. But how do you know? And why should you pay $1 million to find out? Mm-hmm. When you can find another horse that went a reasonable speed and showed it can carry it. Mm-hmm. I don't just rely on that. We developed and patented and have thousands and thousands of horses. We look at their organs, the size of their lungs, the efficiency of their heart, the volume of the left ventricle, and all that kind of, we're looking at biomechanics inside as well as outside. Mm-hmm. Other things they do wrong. Some horses, they wing, their horses go out, their legs go round and like the crew team from Harvard, it looks like they're rowing their way up the racetrack. Some of them, they bend their leg and they come all the way up. The hoof comes all the way up in retraction and it hits them in the chest. Some of them bang their forehooves into their back hooves and then their feet get hot. And then people wonder why, his feet are hot. They're wondering why their limbers, why they don't want to go in the gate because it hurts.
Mm-hmm.
And I could go on and on and on. And all these things are obvious in high definition, slow motion, which most people don't look at. They don't need it.
Let me ask you one other question. I noticed when I was looking at the betting odds this year, it's the first time I can remember in a long time no horse was anywhere near like 1-to-1 or even less than 1-to-1. Is that what do you attribute that to this year?
Well, I don't know. Maybe it's a good crop of horses. Maybe there's no standout. Maybe it's because we've done a better job of eliminating cheating.
Well, that's what that's why I'm asking you. So let me ask you a question.
I don't know.
I'm saying you've come up with two different empirical the cheating one could be you come up with three, but let's go with the first two. How do we know? You would know, but how would a normal person know? It could be all the horses are great. That's why there's no standout. It could be none of the horses are great. When you look at the field of horses this year, is this like, is anyone coming, let me just frame it as a lay person. Is anyone coming near Secretariat's record this year or no way?
Secretariat went the 1.25 miles in under 2 minutes. And then that almost nobody in the 3-year-old is Kentucky Derby has ever done it again. Somebody came close. So there's your standard. No, nobody's going to break 2 minutes. It's the fastest time I've got one that I thought might hit it at, what do I have? Hold on. I had one at 2 minutes flat. Where the hell is that?
Mo Donegal?
No, it's not Mo Donegal. Hold on a second. Yes, it is Mo Donegal. I'm sorry. It was Mo Donegal. Hit it at 2 minutes flat, and he's my favorite.
And where would that be? Just tell us, in the distribution of, like, if you look at the last 60, 70 winners of the Derby. Would that be in the top 10% of times? Like, is that a really fast time?
If he does it, yes.
Okay.
But you never know, because the Derby is, you know, it's a cavalry charge. The horses often don't get a chance. They're banged around. They have to, if they show early speed and go right to the front, they may get tired. It's a mile and a quarter and they've never done it. If they don't go to the front, they're banged around and they're blocked. And there's, you know, there's 20 horses there and they're pumping dirt in their face and into their eyes. And, you know, it's just, and they may have to go run an extra eighth of a mile to go around all that mess. And if it's not, if it rains, it's even wilder.
Well, that's, so I was going to ask you a question. And one of the things that always,
a lot of luck and just to the trip.
Is there an optimal temperature for the race if one wanted to maximize the time? Like they say for marathons, the optimal temperature is like 50, 55 degrees. What is it for horse racing? Like if someone tells you, you know, the announcer comes on, it's 98 degrees today at Churchill Downs. And you're like, well, you could forget 2 minutes. You might as well add 10 seconds onto that.
Yeah, they're all going to sweat it off before they get to the starting gate. Horses suffer more in heat and humidity than they do in the winter in the cold. And then having lived on a farm with horses, heat and humidity are killers. A nice, cool, clear day is when you're going to get your...
Is it more about the effect on the horses, like the ambient temperature and humidity, or more how it affects the actual track, like the muddiness?
I don't know, but
like
we know from humans that the spring constant in the track, as it changes or in the running surface, makes an enormous difference. Mm-hmm. And everybody, you know, if you can match that spring constant of the surface to the time that they're pushing down and the time that, and then the track's pushing back as they push off, you get much faster times, and whoever can match it, whoever's gait is tuned to that surface has a huge advantage. But, you know, knowing a horse's spring constant and the track spring constant versus, is it, nobody knows.
Right.
Nobody's got that data. I mean, I've had it in research, but in a race, who the hell?
Jeff, let's talk a few more about some other horses. There's a Japanese horse that nobody knows about. There's a UAE horse.
The two big 67-1 Pioneer Medina. His daddy was one of the horses that we were part of managing and being part of. The sire of his dam was a horse we bought as a young horse. Had the race of the year before, and he was his favorite for the Derby before he got hurt the week before. Pioneer Medina, 67-1.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think so. I think he's going to be up front.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one I like is a Cinderella Zosos, Z-O-S-O-S. Young horse, not a great pedigree. Only three races in his life, supposedly doesn't have a shot,
mm-hmm.
but he's not slowing down.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
you give us these heuristics that are helpful to work with sometimes. So, for example, pedigree. I mean, if you saw two equally priced horses and one had a better pedigree than the other, you probably want the other one according to the rule of thumb that you're giving us. Are there any other rules of thumb that you would suggest? I mean, but you know, age, these horses are not all exactly the same age or number of races. What do you think the market misses?
Well, the problem with the pedigree is that the data is so garbled. The very best stallions and the very best, you know, all the stuff that costs $1 billion to breed, except, you know, 95% of their horses aren't anything special. So, mm-hmm. but they get all the best of everything. They get the best mm-hmm. training, the best veterinarians, the best management, the best blah, blah, blah. And it just garbages up the database. So it's a poor predictor to begin with, although it is a predictor. Okay. And then it's the database around it is so biased. I mean, it's not reliable. Plus you have to know which trainers were juicing their horses. And some of the stallions, you know, are from trainers that are notorious. I'm sorry, I'm not really answering your question. Tell me that question again. I'll be more direct.
What else do you think the market might tend to get wrong? You think the market tends to overprice pedigrees. Are there any other features? Like, do they miss
age?
They
overprice the speed. They overprice the speed of the workout vastly. They overprice pedigree vastly.
Okay.
What
about just uncertainty?
The other stuff is they just miss a lot. They miss a lot of indicators that the horse is going to have a high probability of being injured, have a short career. They don't look for them.
Mm-hmm.
They don't use the tools that are available generally because mm-hmm. they don't, I don't know why. Because it's, you know, I don't know why. Maybe it's my fault. I'm too much of a curmudgeon.
You're doing what you can, Jeff. You're doing what you can.
So, Jeff, let me ask you a question. There's a known phenomenon. You'll see the analogy in a second. In education, where, you know, if you take a top school like we're at the Wharton School, and you look at the relationship between someone taking like the SAT and grades, it has no predictive value because every, you know, if you look at the, it has for the whole population, but not once you're at the top end. It does the same true in horse racing. These are all the elite of the elite horses. So I assume you're not saying that, for example, the size of the horse, the strength of the horse, all those things could be predictive of a good horse, but they're not predictive of an elite horse that's going to win an elite race. Is that analogy close at all to the way it works in horse racing?
Or just to add pedigree onto that too, maybe the pedigrees, because they're so selected for by the industry that you just don't have a lot. If you looked at the kind of variation in pedigree of all horses, that would be very predictive, but because you're focusing on a very specific kind of, like, you know, pedigree of only elite horses already, there's no real predictive power within them.
Well, first of all, the 20 to get in the Kentucky Derby, you have to be one of the most points that you have to win the right races. They are the 20 elite horses. Size makes an enormous difference. A lot of the things you mentioned make a difference. Does it make a difference between these horses?
Yeah, that's the question. Yeah.
No. But what does make, there are things that do make, there are half the horses in this field that I would not bet on at all, no matter what. I don't think they have a shot. And why don't I think they have a shot? Because they've run several races, and they have shown that they extrapolate the times. They're not going to make a time that's fast enough to win this race, mm-hmm. either because they don't try hard enough or they get tired. Mm-hmm. When I was younger, I actually rode racer, exercised them. We would go out in sets on farms with racehorses. And I can tell you that some of them were happy to be in the back, and you had to, you know, tell them when you needed them to do something. And some of them would die. They would kill you or die themselves before they would be behind another horse. They were impossible. And Secretary didn't need anybody to tell him to try hard. He would die before he would be second, before he wouldn't going to pass that horse, or if he got headed before he didn't show him. So, whoever invents the way to read that in the horse's mind, mm-hmm. that's a lot of the difference in these 20 horses. Well, mm-hmm. actually 10 of them, forget it, whatever. But the other 10, man, that's still a big factor. There's a lot of horses when they get headed, they give up.
Mm-hmm.
And there's other horses when they get headed, they'll kill the other. There's cases where the horse, when he got headed, he reached over and bit the horse next to him.
Jeff, when you, the term get headed, that means when someone steps, gets ahead of him?
They come up next to him and they get their head a little in front. Some horses will then turn and kick them or bite them when you're on the farm when they try that. So don't you dare. I remember we bought one yearling. We went out in the field looking at a big bunch of yearlings. And there was one, they all had short tails because they all bite each other's tails when they're playing. One had a big long tail. Nobody messed with that horse. So we bought it. And it was a good horse.
And there you go, guys. There's
another yearling that was a great, really. We went out and it was feeding time. They're bringing in like 20, 30 yearlings in the field. And they're all coming to the gate because they want to go to the barn and get their dinner. And then all of a sudden the Red Sea parts and one of this filly comes through. And I thought, mm-hmm. that's it, baby. Mm-hmm. We want that horse.
That is so interesting. All right. So makeup, you know, baseball player evaluations, scouts call it makeup. We just had to figure out how to assess. They have a hard time assessing it in a pitcher. Now we need to assess.
There's no free agents in horse racing. So you got to figure out who gives a damn. I was at Hialeah years and years ago, and it was a race, and it was a cheap race, but there were like 15 horses. And usually they finish like an eighth of a mile all the way from the eighth pole to the end of the finish line. They're all stretched out at the end of the race. A collie got out on the track and it was chasing them, and they have finished it all in a, you could have thrown a blanket over the whole bunch of them.
Oh my gosh, really?
And the guy next to me turned to me and he said, that's what happens when they're all trying.
That is remarkable. Listen, we'll end on that one. That's a good note to end on. Jeff, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. It's even more fun. We get to do it. We get to look at you on Zoom here. Thank you for making the time for this. We wish you the best with how the Derby goes down in your household.
Well, Well, thank you very much for having me. And I updated my thing that I sent you, and I added Pioneer and Medina. And let's hope that he gives a damn whether he's
all right. All right. We got it. You got it, guys. Now enjoy the race. And that has been another Wharton Moneyball. We do 2 hours here every year, every week on SiriusXM for the whole crew. The whole crew has been here for these 2 hours. Eric Bradlow, Shane Jensen, Audie Weiner. This is Kay Massey for the boss man, Maddie Datz, for the associate boss man, Dion Simpkins. Thank you guys for listening. Come back and join us next time. Between now and then, enjoy your sports.